Hi, I'm Danielle Carmanis. Welcome back to Karma Has Spoken. Make sure you stay tuned later on when I talk to Josh Malerman, the author of The Bird Box, which has had me up since 3:30 this morning. It's going to be a great interview. Stay tuned. But first, if you have any sense of rhythm at all, I'll just bet that you're bouncing to the beat of the track you're hearing now. It's called Up All Night, and it is the latest song by our next guest, a gifted musician performer named Stevie Soul. An amazing part of his story is how his musical journey began and has blossomed into the artistry that he shares with the world on stage during live performances, as well as through collaborations with an incredible diversity of artists. You see, as a child, Stevie struggled with a stuttering disorder, but he was able literally to transform his voice into a multifaceted musical instrument and excel as a beatboxer. He's been using that skill and other talents to inspire countless people ever since. Welcome.
Thank you.
Did I get it all right?
You got it all in there.
Okay, so tell me, first of all, the name.
Stevie Soul.
Yeah.
So
was that your given name?
My name is Steven. Stevie was a name that came when I was younger, and Soul has a kind of an interesting backstory to it. So my older brother is a music producer, and he used to have a studio in our basement growing up. His friends would come over, record, jam out in the basement. And I had this weird thing where I loved cleaning shoes.
That's a really weird thing.
I know, it's really weird.
Do you still have that weird thing?
Because yeah,
I have some shoes.
Yes, and I'm looking at those and I'm like,
they're a little bit bad right now.
It was just a weird thing. I'm obsessed with cleaning and organizing.
Okay.
And so I used to clean my shoes in the basement, like on top of the washer and dryer next to where they would record. And so when his friends would come over, they would see me cleaning and kind of organizing and doing my thing, and they would have me clean their shoes while they were in recording sessions.
I bet they would.
Yes.
Wait,
so
did
I'd
they pay
couple,
you?
Yes, I'd make a couple bucks off of it, and so they started calling me Stevie Soul, and it sort of stuck. It was originally S-O-L-E.
Of course,
and then they kind of saw me performing while I was cleaning, and they just sort of started, I was the younger brother, so it just started making sense, and they started kind of noticing me singing along, beatboxing, and doing my thing, and they kind of gave me the name Stevie Soul, and it stuck ever since.
Wow. Yeah. So then how did beatboxing become a thing for you, right? So you had this stutter, and so tell us a little bit about that experience,
and you were bullied.
Beatboxing kind of changed all of that for you, right?
Yeah, so growing up, I had a severe stuttering problem, and I would always get caught up on the first letter and could never push the full word out. So I would, for example, my brother's name was Billy, and I would try to say Billy, but I and I would just notice that these sounds would come out as I would attempt to say his name. So I would take the those sounds and arrange them into beats and patterns, and that helped me kind of understand sentence structure, and it gave me like an internal rhythm. I found my internal rhythm through just taking the struggle of trying to say the word and then the sound coming out, kind of taking it and just arranging them into different beats and patterns. And I just used it as like a technique to kind of like slow down, teach myself to kind of like figure this out and work through it. But it was really a struggle. A lot of words I was trying to say, I would always get caught up on that first letter, and there would always be like sounds like trying to come out. So I just really arranged them and kind of started organizing them back to the organization thing, and really just kind of finding beats and rhythms. And it just became my unique way of expressing myself.
So had you always been interested in music? Because you're very musical in your mannerisms, right? Like more than I've ever noticed with anyone before. So as you're talking, there's almost, in the way your shoulders move and the way your hands move, there's like a cadence and a rhythm to how you carry yourself. So how old were you when you started to put this all together?
About middle school.
Okay.
It was a real, I mean, I'm sort of like skipping over years of struggle. And,
sure. Well, middle school is no walk in the park.
It really
right?
isn't, for sure. You know, my parents are immigrants from Jordan. And so their English wasn't, that's important to note, because their English wasn't the greatest. And, you know, they were still figuring things out themselves. So trying to help me.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Redford.
Okay.
I was actually born in Garden City, and I saw that somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I was born in Garden City Hospital.
Me too.
Okay.
So I saw that.
I'm older than you, though. How old are you?
I'm 32.
Oh, okay.
I was going for it. I saw that and I connected the dots there. But I grew up in Redford, and it was just a huge struggle. No one really knew how to help me.
Sure.
I didn't really know how to help myself at that point. And so I just needed something to latch onto to like be good at.
Mm.
And I just quickly figured out that I could do this thing back then, I didn't really know beatboxing was an art form. I definitely didn't know I could make a career, a potential career out of it back then. It was just this thing that I did that I really enjoyed.
So is there a single example, or tell us quickly about when the bullies became your fans?
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Even honestly, just saying that gives me goosebumps.
Yeah. What a great turn of events. Mm. So, you know, the same kids that were making fun of me and picking on me a little bit. So in middle school, in high school, were now asking me to do that thing you do. And do that
wow.
thing. You'd, and it's like,
did
no
you
one
do
really,
it?
I did it every time. Every time I did it. Like that. And later in life, my father always told me that, like, in order to be a real performer, you have to, when someone says perform or asks you to perform, you just got to stop what you're doing and do it.
Yeah.
There's something special about that. And a lot of doors will open up. And boy, was he right. And, you know, he was the one that also told me to open up about my stuttering. For many years, I never spoke about it. I was too embarrassed as like a, you know, then as like a single guy growing up, why would I want to talk about any flaw that I had? Or so I was really embarrassed about it and never spoke about it.
Well, it would be a tough time to go back to, right?
But
it's such an inspiring story.
Definitely.
Right? So when you see yourself as an artist, what does that look like for you? Do you see yourself as just a beatboxer, or what other type of talents and interests do you have that you're working on?
Yes. Well, initially I did. I saw myself as a beatboxer. And then since I've been doing it for so long, I have always been trying to push myself and experiment with different things. And then I started singing a little bit as part of my performance. So I used to take a microphone and plug it into a guitar loop pedal. So I would plug the microphone into where most people would plug a guitar, and I would just loop my voice. And then that gave me the opportunity to sing on top of my beats. And it really opened up a world of opportunity. Because yes, beatbox does have like a stigma to it, where it's like, it's some dude on a street corner with his hands over his mouth. And I just saw myself as so much more than that. And I grew up loving R&B music and hip hop. And there was just so much more than just that basic beat that you normally hear a beatboxer kick out. And so I really wanted to challenge myself to like figure it out and figure out what my sound and style was. And I just did it. Luckily the loop pedal thing existed. I plugged this mic into it and then just let it rip, and then was able to add and build on top of that. And that really helped me find my groove and my rhythm and expand and layer. And
So do you think you're going to stay in Detroit?
I think so. Yeah.
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 So where can we find you?
Well, I actually performed at the Sugar House last night, which is an awesome venue. And I play with Nicole New, and I sat in with the whole jazz jam band.
Oh, Nicole New is amazing.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Okay. So when you're playing with her, what are you playing? What are you doing?
I beatbox and do a lot of horn section stuff. So I fill in with a lot of horns and do a lot of different sort of improv style stuff. It's kind of all over the map.
I mean, listen, everyone who is listening to us right now, they need to find you. They need to listen to you. They need to just watching you talk, and we start to kick it out a few beats. I don't want you to stop, right? I wish everyone who was listening was here in the trailer with us right now and could see the way, just kind of the way your body kind of has a cadence when you're talking. I can't wait to see you perform live. So do you have a website?
Of
Where
course,
can we find out more about
Stevie,
you?
StevieSoul.com.
S-O-U-L.
S-O-U-L. Yeah, over the years, yes, of course.
And you're not doing shoes anymore.
No, only personal projects. Only personal. And I could take care of those for you, too. I have a very exclusive VIP client list now that I only deal with. But StevieSoul.com. And I'm on Instagram and all social media. And I perform all over town all the time. A lot of random spot gigs. And because of the nature of beatboxing, it allows me to sit in and perform with a lot of different musicians and artists. And I take full advantage of that.
Yeah.
So I perform everywhere, and I sit in with all kinds of bands and groups. And I'm always performing.
Well, you have an incredible story. And I really appreciate how hard it must have been for you to go back to a time when kids were cruel and you were struggling with something that you probably seemed hopeless at times. And I'm sure it was very, very heartbreaking for your parents to see you suffering. And you came out, you found a tool, you came out on the other side of it, and you went back there to share your story. And I think that takes so much courage. And I think you're changing so many lives. And I hope that people who are listening, if they are struggling with a stutter or know someone who has, I really believe they're going to look to your story for inspiration. So I thank you for sharing that, but you're also so fascinating and super entertaining and absolutely adorable. And we have a photographer who's here taking video as we're doing this, because I think there's a documentary being made on you, right? So that'll be done sometime soon.
Next year.
Okay. So we want everyone to check out your website, follow you, you know, see you in person, and find out where they can go to see the documentary. Okay. So. Thank you, Stevie Soul.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Appreciate it. My pleasure. Our next guest's debut novel was published in 2014 to great critical acclaim. That book was Bird Box. Now, if the mere mention of that title makes you jittery, bug-eyed, and looking around for something to use as a blindfold, well, then you are one of the millions of people that watched the Netflix adaptation starring Sandra Bullock that became a worldwide phenomenon last year. In addition, he's written dozens of novels, many short stories, and the sequel to Bird Box titled Mallory. As if that wasn't enough, he's also part of the Detroit rock band, The High Strung, whose hit song, The Luck You Got, is the opening song for the American version of the hit Showtime series, Shameless. Hi, Josh Mallerman.
Hello.
So why The High Strung? Why is The High Strung called The High Strung?
Because
I feel like I have an idea.
Man, at the time, I think we really embraced how neurotic we were. And we thought there was something endearing. You know, we were like 24.
Okay, wait, who's we?
The me and the boys in the band, which we've all been best friends since we were 11 or something.
Really?
And then we're still playing now, and we're in our 40s. And
so wait, when you met when you were 11, were you all musical? Like, what brought you together?
So Derek, the drummer, Chad, the bass player, were already playing when we were like 10. I didn't really understand what they were doing, you know? They would play like talent shows, and I would be just as wild as everyone else. But I was already trying to write short stories, trying to write, like the worst poems ever.
As an 11-year-old?
Yeah, okay. Even in through like all those years. And then at some point, you know, other guys joined the band and other friends and blah, blah, blah. And they were like, you should write our songs. And I was like, what does that mean? What's that logic? I've never even touched it, you know? So at some point they bought me an organ and they taught me G and C and other chords. And then this other fellow in the band, Mark, he started singing those poems along with the organ. And it was this realization, oh, this is how you write songs. You know, I didn't think of it. We already have these like stacks of words, and forget those even. Let's write new words, but this is how it's done. I'll play the organ. Derek plays drums. Mark sings. And that was sort of the birth of everything when I was around like 19. But we'd already been friends for like a decade.
These are really good friends. They really wanted you in the crew.
I mean, you know how it is. That's like 19-year-old logic. It's like we all hang out. You're in the band.
Yeah.
And then Mark and I like kind of fell madly in love with songwriting. Him and I must have written, you know, 200, 300 songs together or something.
So I'm not musical. Okay, I'm pretty sure I'm tone deaf, but I appreciate music. I have kids who are very musical. One's playing the violin. And so one's doing the cello, which is kind of
awesome.
So awesome. Tell me a little bit more about being in the band, what the process of writing is like for you. So when you guys were writing hundreds and hundreds of songs, was it just sitting around and something to do? And then what did it feel like for you when you went from writing just for fun to now it being a job? Was it as fun?
So Mark and I, we didn't really, what's the right phrase? We discovered early on that the organ wasn't going to cut it, right? It wasn't enough. I'm just like playing G and C and we're like trying to sing along. And then he and I both taught ourselves how to play the guitar. This is way back when we were 19 years old, whatever. And we had a 4-track recorder at the time, a 4-track cassette recorder. And this was like a life-changing device for us because you could record the guitar, record it again, whatever, add bass, and then you could sing, and then you could fix it if you sing wrong. And so it was sort of like we learned how to write songs on this device. And we recorded like, again, dozens of songs in that way, just him and I. And the drummer, Derek, had moved to New York at that time. So we would send him the tapes when we were done. And at some point, he was like, why don't you guys just move out here also, and we'll play together?
Why not?
I mean, Derek could have been in Idaho. He could have been in France. And I think we would have been like, yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
You know, no,
so were you in school at the time?
So we made a go of it. We each had one semester to go at Michigan State. And we're like, screw this. I was trying to write a novel by then, trying to write my first novel. We're writing these songs. It was obvious that we were, we had like found our way or something. We don't need this anymore. We went out to New York, ran out of money in a hurry.
So you went to New York one semester shy of graduating.
Mm-hmm. But then ran out of money, came back home, finished school, and then went out to New York again. So we did graduate from Michigan State, both of us, me and Mark. And then we moved out to New York again.
I wish Mark was here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
Man, so he would, I know.
He would love to be here, actually.
I Shoot. Wish,
maybe we can do that down the road.
Okay, yeah, that would be awesome because we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, and, he's awesome. He's okay. awesome. So then we were all of a sudden, you know, in New York City with a drummer, our best friend Derek, and we were trying out bass players, which was one of the strangest artistic experiences of my life because there was, how do you say this? Typically, it's just always been by feel and momentum, never like a flyer asking for a bass player or like a tryout, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that all just felt weird. And so I started sort of nagging a friend back home named Chad Stocker. And I was nagging him. He played bass. I'm like, come join us. Come join us. New York, like Derek had nagged Mark and I. And Chad did. He moved out to New York. And all of a sudden,
and so, wait,
we're like,
what else was Chad doing at the time?
He was finishing up at Eastern.
Okay. Yep.
He's 2 years younger than us.
Did he graduate?
He ended up graduating.
Okay. All right.
And then we had a fifth guy named Berko, Jason Berkowitz, who was sort of our coach in the early days. He was like a performer. He had his whole life. He had tried out for like Stomp, and he did like dance shows, and he played guitar, and he was sort of our coach. And he was like, you know, you guys are all off rhythm. You need to smile when you're on stage. All these kind of things.
Shoot.
And from
just
the word
real.
Go, yeah, yeah. He was sort of like when things got real. He said to us from the word go, he's like, I'm going to be around in New York with you guys for a couple years. I'm going to get you in shape for this, and then I'm going to leave.
Oh.
So we...
Wait, so was he older than you guys?
Yeah, he was.
Okay.
Yeah, like a year or two.
But he was going to commit a couple years of his life to you guys.
Yeah.
And then when you think back on that, isn't that kind of crazy?
It's absolutely incredible. He was asked to join this band of...
Like, I don't want to say a band of misfits because you guys knew what you were doing, but you guys weren't polished performers.
Oh my gosh. No, not at all.
Looking to write, like, you know, a hit song that's going to, you know, be the opening for another hit show.
Right. I remember in the earliest of early days playing a show in New York and Derek messing up and me and Mark both looking at Derek sort of angrily. And I remember Berko pulling us aside after and saying, hey, next time Derek screws up, don't even look at him.
Yeah.
Just smile. And we're like, yeah, but that's not how we feel. I mean, you know, again, 20-year-old logic, right?
Yeah.
That's not how we feel.
Your brain's not developed yet.
And he's like, no. If you smile, you're going to end up having more fun.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, okay, I'll try that. And I tried it the next show and it worked.
Yeah.
Like Derek messed up and it was like, okay, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, and it's contagious for the loose. Audience,
yes,
right? Like,
absolutely.
Great life lesson.
So I never believed that he was going to actually split after those 2 years. I mean, no way. Those 2 years were the best time. I mean, come on. We're like early 20s, New York City, rock band, right?
Yeah.
And then all of
and
a sudden.
And you guys were all living together.
We were all
was
living
Berko
together.
Was living
and,
with you too?
Yes.
Okay.
He ended up moving into his own place, but yeah.
Okay.
We all lived in the same place. And then we made an album, and that album got like reviewed in like Rolling Stone and all this. We were like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And it was so exciting. We were like on the road and just all this stuff. And then Berko, just one day he handed us all a sheet of paper that was like a letter saying that he was leaving, that he had done what he said he was going to do. He came in, he got us in shape. You know, he took these like artistic weirdos and turned them into like a, you know, somewhat comprehensible rock band. And then he left.
Berko!
Yeah. And we were like, wait, come on.
Yeah.
You're not serious. But he did. He moved to LA and he's been there ever since.
Wow. So what's he doing now?
Well, he does a lot of things. He's like a consultant to restaurants, and he just wrote a book on the restaurant business and like the right protocol. And I think it's called like Don't Sleep with the Hostess.
Oh, life lesson. Yeah. I mean, we're just this podcast is just, I hope whoever's listening like has a paper and pen because this is just filled.
Yeah. You can argue that he was like a consultant to our band.
Right.
That he came in, he's like, you don't need this. You need to do this. You need to do that. And it was very like to the point. And
I wish Berko was here too.
Yeah. Well, the whole band's. They're all.
I wish the whole band was here.
It's a bunch of like funny.
So, but
Jewish
Berko,
dudes.
What a life. Like just going around, like helping people fix things. I'm going to give you 2 years. We're going to make this work. You guys are going to really be stars. And then I'm going to leave. And that's what happened. And that's what he did.
Yep.
That in and of itself could be the only thing we talk about in this podcast. And that would be fascinating.
And the last thing he did in our band was he was involved on the song that ended up that theme song for Shameless.
Wow.
So I brought the song out to the band. I had written it outside of a house party in Georgia. We were all like drinking and everyone's inside and I had the guitar outside. And I wrote this song that I felt like it was like Billy Joel or something. I came in and I grabbed Mark. I'm like, I just wrote one outside. It kind of reminds me of Billy Joel. And I played it for him. He's like, that doesn't sound like Billy Joel, dude. And I'm like, all right, good. We go into to practice it, and Berko's like, you should raise this up like a key, and we did. You should raise it another key, and we did. You should raise it another. This should be like a bright, you're singing high, like a rocker. This isn't like a small, understated song.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, okay. And we just listened to him, and that song is the one that ended up is that theme song.
Wow.
he changed that whole like thing. And that's the last thing he did with
us. So does that happen to you a lot where you're at a party and you just grab your guitar and go outside and just write a hit song? Or, I mean, maybe not that, but like, does inspiration just strike anywhere for you?
Yeah.
Where's the weirdest place you've ever written anything?
Well, I wrote 6 or 7 novels in the passenger seat of our tour van.
Yeah, so I read that. So how many days a year were you guys on the road? Like hundreds, right?
Yeah, we played like 250 shows a year for like 6 years or something. And this is after Burko left. He was there for the first run of it.
Okay.
And like he was there for the first 6 months or something.
Okay.
And yeah, like 250 shows a year for 6 years. We didn't have homes, apartments, nothing. We just kept circling the country in Canada. We never even made it to Europe, which still a thorn in my side, but we can, we will,
it's
whatever.
Not too late,
right? Just do it now,
you're young,
right? Let's just do it now. Seriously, let's just do it now. What's the difference? Who cares?
Like, let's just take the trailer, let's just load it up, I don't know, you know, go across the ocean.
So that was, I don't even know, I think I was from like 27 to 34 or something like that
on the road constantly,
or 26 to 33 or something like
okay
that,
so yeah. You're engaged, so at what point in here did you meet your fiance?
So,
and is she from Michigan?
Yeah.
Okay.
She's from like the deep UP, like by you know where Ontonagon is?
No.
Okay. Do you know Houghton?
Yeah.
It's like 15 miles shy of Houghton.
Okay.
Like way up there.
Okay.
Like 10 hours from here.
Yeah.
Wow. We just made that drive recently and it's like, wow.
Pete and I did it a couple years ago. Yeah.
That is the real deal.
Yeah.
Anyway, so at some point, Mark left our band, the other songwriter, and it was just me, Derek, and Chad for a long while. And that was a real, man, that was a fun run.
It was just the three of you traveling around.
Yeah.
And what are you traveling around in?
For a while, we had a short bus,
okay.
And then we had another short bus,
okay.
And then we had a van. But that first short bus, there's a great story about that.
Yeah, I want to hear it.
So we were like parked on a beach in California, and when we woke up, someone was like tagging it.
Oh!
And then we looked out the window, and it was like, whoa, what are you? And then I was like, whoa, no, go on. Yeah, you just finish it. Whatever, it looks better than what it looked like before. Just keep going. This led to wherever we went, people felt free to write on the bus. I wrote the outline of a book on the inside, like the ceiling of the bus. Like there'd be character names everywhere, your list of favorite Who songs, writing. Literally, the vehicle was covered in writing. And when it was dying, when it was just about dead, Derek, the drummer, our CFO, if such a word applies to that operation, he...
Says it, and now does the F in that sound stand for financial? Because I feel like it could really be... Okay.
Barely.
Achieve, I mean, it could be... Chief anything officer, I don't even know.
And then he, Derek was like, we can scrap this for like $200. And $200 was significant at the time. And we were like, and I was like, I was with my mom drinking wine. And I was like, I don't want to scrap this vehicle, Mom. This is like this so much and it's so amazing, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to drive this through the front door of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And then she was like, oh yeah, that's a little violent. Why don't you park it at the front door? I was like, wait, that's a really good idea. So we as a band made a phony like plaque behind plexiglass explaining what this exhibit is. And we drove it to Cleveland and we drove up the stone steps of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, parked the thing like in front off to the side, set up the plaque to make it look like it was like part of the exhibit. It was an exhibit at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it was this description, you know, of why this belonged there and stuff, you know, as if we didn't write it, you know. And then I wrote a letter to the police, like, that I left on the chair, you know?
So wait, what did the letter... Josh, your stories are so good. I never want this interview to end, and we're not even halfway into it. So what did the letter to the police say?
It was pretty much saying, like, I'm leaving the keys here. You shouldn't have to tow it. You can drive it away, and if it's a problem, here, like, just call me.
But what about the $200?
No, yeah, gone.
Oh, it was gone. No, okay, yeah, we were over it when we committed to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the plaque.
Short bus waiting. At the time, Mark was still with us. Mark was driving the getaway short bus. We dropped that off and we all bolted. This is at 3 a.m. in Cleveland. I don't think you could do what we did. I don't think you can do that anymore. I think if you did that, it'd be like a bomb scare. It'd be like some threatening gesture.
Yeah.
But this was after 9/11. This was because we hit the road after 9/11. But for some reason, sometimes I feel like that night at 3 a.m. was the last time somebody could get away with something like that.
Yeah.
If you ever did something like that now, you'd be arrested.
Yeah.
It would be a threat, all these things. But I did hear from the police. They sent me an email. A police officer wrote me, Mr. Mallorin, you're going to get a letter from the Cleveland police, but ignore it. We thought this was funny.
And then did you ever hear from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
No, but back then, so this is in like 04, 05. Okay. And back then there wasn't, you know, Facebook yet, and or at least not like it is now, right?
Right.
We didn't even have
because
one.
This would have gone viral, no doubt.
Right.
Yeah.
I know.
Shoot.
Like, we think about that. We're like, oh my God, man. But there were chat rooms, and I went into a chat room at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and all these people were like, because it was in the Free Press, it was in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, it was in all these papers. Oh. And I was, I saw all these people like, this is so rock and roll, you have to accept this van. Like, this is more rock and roll than half the bands. You know, that's what people would say. And then the staff at the Hall of Fame were like, you know, there are proper channels in which to, you know, as if I would have taken those channels, that would have been a more exciting way to do this, right? So that's what happened to our first van, yeah.
Oh, and then how did you meet your fiancé?
Wow. I forgot about that. That was so far into this. So Mark leaves. The other three of us are on the road for years. And then at some point I was just like, we need another guitar player.
Wait, but so you're on the road for years, no home base at this point.
Yep.
Oh, okay. So you're just living out of the short bus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or like say, by then we knew someone in every city.
Okay.
And again, I'm writing novels in the passenger seat. I mean, stuff is almost like, in hindsight, it seems like things were about to explode. Not in a success way, but in an artistic way or something.
Okay.
I was writing novels, like one a month or something. We're traveling like crazy. We're drinking. We're playing shows. We're, you know, it was just so electrifying, this period. And then and we didn't like, the idea of having an apartment would have been like, to us would have been, what's the right word for that? It would have almost been embarrassing.
Yeah.
We were like, this is so amazing what we're doing.
That's like, an interesting word. Down. Like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So we're going about it. And then finally I was like, you know, we need a second guitar player again because I was alone all those years. And I asked this dude, Stephen Palmer, and he was in a band in Detroit. I asked him if he wanted to join. He said no. And then like a year later, he was like, I asked him again. And he's like, yeah, I do want to join your band now.
So did his life change or was he just waiting to watch and see what happened with you
this
guys?
This was about exactly when we got off the road.
Okay.
So now we're, now I lived in, I don't even remember where I lived when Stephen joined the band,
okay.
But we lived around,
okay.
Like around the Detroit area.
Okay.
And then we had a show, a record release show. And at these shows, I would wear like, Sharpie on my face, like face paint or something.
Wait, what?
kind of like a football player, I guess, you know, like the black lines under the eyes. And
but you would use Sharpie to do it?
Yeah, I know. In hindsight, it was so weird, man. But I'm surprised I don't have like something wrong with my face, right? What if you're like, oh, I can tell. I can tell you use Sharpie on your face, dude. So we play the show. And afterwards, this stunning Finnish woman came up to me and she was all eyes and legs. And she was like, hey, I like to paint my face also. Can I have some of yours? And then I reached in my pocket for the Sharpie as if I was going to draw on her. She grabbed my face and rubbed it against hers, both cheeks. And then she pulled away and she's like, did it work? And I was like, okay, we're dating.
Something worked.
We're like, this is, you're it. And we've been together for 7 years.
Wow. Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Wait, and did the Sharpie rub off on her face?
Yes, it
oh,
did.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, I mean, right away, I was like, oh, this girl's creative
she gets
as
it.
I am.
Yeah. She can meet me at the Sharpie.
And I always, before meeting Allison, I used to think that having like a girlfriend, like a writer or an artist girlfriend would be like too much of that in the house or something. Like, my God, one of us has to be rooted in reality, right? And so I meet her and I'm like, I don't know if this is a good idea. Like not.
Wait, so what does Allison? Oh boy, what does Allison do?
So Allison is a really holy cow singer, classical guitar player. She's a painter and she's an actress. I mean, she's really like everything.
Oh,
if you go to her like Instagram, you'll see like, she does special, like monster special effects. She does like body paint. She,
all right, what's her,
portraits.
What is her Instagram?
Neuron Paint. Neuron Paint.
Okay. And so do you guys ever collaborate?
Yeah. We played like shows together. We made a real bizarre movie together that we just filmed like on a camera. We bought it, you know, what's that, Best Buy or something?
What was it about?
You said this is a family friendly.
Well-
I can't even tell you the title of the movie.
Okay.
But I mean, we
okay,
premiered.
Okay, so you guys have fun.
Yeah. But we premiered the movie at the main art theater in Royal Oak. So it's not like it was like some nasty thing or something, but it was, man.
But I'm not taking my kids.
No, my gosh. In fact, there were kids in the lobby. There were kids in the lobby because we had these standees of the characters and they're all like pretty cartoonish looking. Allison played a boy,
okay.
The lead boy in it. And these kids were like, we want to see this movie. And we're like, no, you're no, you're not allowed in this theater. We watched it the other night, actually, for the first time in a while, Allison and I. But yeah, so we have collaborated. But I would love to do something with, I would definitely want to make another movie with her. I would definitely want to make an album with her. But I almost want to, like, get her to write a book. Every time, she's like a good writer.
Okay.
She really is.
So what's her genre?
Like with writing?
Mm-hmm.
Like fantasy stuff.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your process now for writing? So now you're not on the road. It's such a fascinating concept for me when I think about you're writing like dozens of novels or your stories as you're on the road. Were you sitting in the front seat? You're the passenger? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was your spot.
Yeah.
And do you write longhand or do you type?
Both. I did four novels longhand. And I liked doing that because it forced a rewrite. You know, obviously you can't hand it to anyone this way.
Yeah.
So you would be forced to type it in.
There's a popular fiction writer, Elin Nordebrand. She does, you know, just like popular, like romantic things. And she only writes longhand and she does her best writing when she's in some sort of a moving vehicle. So she lives on Nantucket. Yeah. And so she'll take the ferry back and forth because the motion just kind of keeps her engaged. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
I've literally never heard of another person doing something like that. I almost like, I'm going to look her up now.
Yeah.
Because that's cool.
She's pretty cool. I saw her speak once in Nantucket and I was super starstruck. Then I asked for a selfie and I was like, super loser. But like writers are fascinating people and I'm so fascinated by the process. So like even trying to understand how you were working when you're in the front seat and you're writing, like, did you have like a certain outfit that you wore? Although you were on the road, so you probably didn't have a lot of clothes. Like, did you have to have your feet up on the dash when you're writing? Was there like a whole kind of routine that had to happen for you to get in your zone?
I have more of that now. Like I always dress up in like a sports jacket and button down shirt when I write.
And a pipe?
No, more like Rod Serling.
Okay.
Than the English professor.
Okay.
More like we're about to tell you like a bizarre story.
I just feel like everything you do is so interesting. I feel like eating breakfast for you is probably like an interesting production. No, it's not.
Totally.
Oh, shoot. We just took a turn.
Sorry about that.
So, Bird Box.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of questions around Bird Box. But there are so many interesting things to talk about with you, right? That I think talking about Bird Box seems like the obvious go-to subject with you, but there are so many things that you're doing that are so interesting. It's just one of many fascinating things. And I don't know, I mean, like, it's almost hard not to ramble and or almost hard to articulate this, that, I mean, you wrote a novel that was picked up by Netflix, that became a movie, that became a sensation, that Sandra Bullock produced and starred in. I mean, it was a worldwide phenomenon last year. And that's not even like the most interesting thing about you. I mean, that's like, this is crazy.
I think some of my friends sometimes are like, because like we've had so many adventures and stories together that Bird Box almost seems like a pop song to them or something.
I get it.
Whereas like these other experiences were like these epic.
Yeah. Like I always research the guests and I have a list of prepared questions and they're of course almost entirely around Bird Box. If you're around being a musician, but talking to you out of the gate, I'm like, no, I want to know about you at 19. I want to know about you traveling around. These are really amazing stories. I want to know about you and Allison in the movies, you know, but Bird Box. So I personally have not seen a horror movie or, you know, any sort of a scary movie since I was maybe 11 or 12.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. And I saw Nightmare on Elm Street with Freddy Krueger. Yeah. I didn't sleep for years.
I saw that about 11 or 12 also, yeah.
It was awful, right?
I watched it recently and
Oh my God, are you kidding?
I mean,
no.
I
can barely wear stripes.
It's amazing. I just got that sweater recently.
No.
At the Spirit Halloween.
No.
I swear. And then
that doesn't surprise me. But you're not wearing it for a costume, are you?
No. Yes. It's in my closet, like hanging in front of my suit jackets. But I watched it recently and it's actually like a better movie than I would have
known.
Really?
Like 12. It holds up?
Yeah. But it's not scary, man.
Oh, it was like, so
there's
scary.
Like Eddie Van Halen like soloing like the scary parts and stuff. It's like, you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
No, this isn't scary. But when I was 12 and the body bag, like walking down, being dragged down the hall.
Awful.
And falling asleep in class and all that. Oh, my God.
Oh, and the sound of the nails.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. Okay, so in the name of research, I thought, well, I have to watch Bird Box. So I watched it last week. Yeah, but in all honesty, I had it on while I was like making cookies, right? So I was like trying to balance out the whole experience. Like, I'll make something really sweet for my kids while I'm watching this really scary movie because people are terrified by this movie. And it completely sucked me in. I loved it. I thought it didn't bother me. Then I was up at 3:30 in the morning and I thought I was seeing the faces. And then since, I feel like I keep seeing the faces everywhere. Like there was a guy with a Harley Davidson jacket on and there was a skull in the background. Then I on the back and I thought maybe that was one of the faces and I thought it was pulling me in. This is messed with my head.
Good. Good.
That's what I'm trying to say.
I got to get you the book for sure. Man.
I know. I think my husband would read the book. I don't think I could handle it. Oh, he would, but I don't think I could handle it.
The book is definitely scarier. The movie is more like an adventure or something. Like it's more like a thriller. And the book is more scary. It's like a horror story.
So when you're writing the horror stories or the thrillers, are you intending to terrify people?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then are there parts that you're writing and you like, do you get like giddy and excited thinking this is going to scare the bejesus out of
yes.
people?
I had a few moments where I had to get up and like I was like, ooh, boy.
You got the chills.
Yeah, there was a couple times. Yeah, I'm trying to remember one off the, what was it? There was one somewhat recently. I'll try to remember before this conversation ends. I can't remember what it is right now, but I had to call Allison into the room. I'm like, hey, what are you doing? She's like, did you just scare yourself? Why are you randomly?
See, you need to like suddenly bake some sugar cookies watch Toy Story.
But there was something recently. It was one of the more recent ones.
Do you think Bird Box is the scariest book you've written? I think it probably isn't.
It's up there though, because that book's an arrow, man. There's no, you know, some of the other ones, like I wrote an 1100 pager recently that is more, more in like the head and like, you know, more like in the, what's the right phrase? More like philosophical than Bird Box.
Okay.
Bird Box is just like an arrow. Like mom says to kids, we are going on this river. Then it's like the river, the house,
yeah.
River, building, giving birth, monsters, you know, it's like very, very intense.
Yeah.
And
I love the cast, by the way.
Oh,
so
yes.
What did you think of the cast? I mean, is it what you were imagining when you were writing?
No. In the book, Mallory is 26 years old. So start there. And so when I found out that Sandra Bullock was going to play Mallory, I mean, there was maybe a half second where I was like, well, she's a little, oh, great.
It's Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, oh, great, done. I've seen people, I'm like, oh, she's older than Mallory. Who cares?
Right.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. She's so intense. She, yeah. And John Malkovich.
Yeah. Yep. Oh. No, I know. Sarah Paulson. I met all these people, by the way. I was like on the set and at the premiere, two premieres in LA and New York. And that's really exciting because in the contract, it said that they had to fly me to the LA premiere.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this sense when you're there, like, well, they had to invite you. I mean, like, it's literally in the contract. But the New York one, that's not in the contract. And they were like, do you want to come again? I'm like, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so I felt like that we had, like, Allison and I feel like Allison and I are adders. We add to the moment.
Yeah.
We add to the party. We add to the scene. We're not subtractors.
For sure.
We're not going to piss anyone off or, like, make a scene.
And you're fun.
Yeah,
so did you hang out with any of the cast?
Yeah. Like we got wasted all night and everything.
So wait, what?
No, it was amazing. We were at like that, especially in New York. There was this amazing moment where my dad was at that premiere. Both my mom and dad were. But Sandra Bullock had sort of like a roped off area.
Of course.
Where she was dancing with friends and stuff like that. And my dad just walked right through the rope, like walked right up to her. Can I get a selfie with you? And she was like, yeah. And then they talked about Bird Box and like he tells me like she talked about me for a while and stuff. And it's like amazing, you know. When I met her, this is crazy. I met her in L.A. on set. It was in a sound studio. So it's this giant open warehouse. It's the scene where the car flips over, right? With her mm-hmm, and Sarah Paulson mm-hmm. driving. All right. So that's like lit up, but nothing else is lit up. It's all shadows beyond that. But that little area is lit up where they're filming. So we're there for like 12 hours, Allison and I, and also my manager, agent, lawyer, like we were invited, you know, we're all there. And it's just crazy. We're like, this is unbelievable all day. The end of the day, this producer walks up to me. He's like, hey, Josh, I want to introduce you to someone. I was like, I was like, oh my God, I'm about to meet Sandra Bullock. Oh my God. Oh boy. For a second, I didn't think this was going to happen. Oh, here we go. And he guides me through a bunch of people out to under those lights. And everyone else like kind of shuffled, you know, back into the shadows. And all of a sudden, I was just meeting Sandra Bullock, like, under stage lights. And I was like, this is unbelievable.
Wow.
And she, like, had makeup and the outfit on for the movie, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, it made you think that her whole life was literally spotlit.
Oh,
like, that
my
this is,
gosh.
Like, when I met her.
Yeah.
And the very first thing she said is, she was like, I know, you hate it, right? You hate everything about what we're doing. You know, she was being hilarious.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I was like, no. I'm, like, so happy this is happening. Oh, my God. And she was, you know, we talked for a while, and I introduced her to, oh, Oh my gosh, at the buzzer, I introduced her to Allison. It was almost like, all right, thanks. And I was like, wait. This is Allison. And I still think to this day, I'm like, oh my God, thank God I had the presence of mind to do that, man, because that would have sucked. Like years later, like, yep, he didn't introduce me. You know?
Oh yeah, that story never would have ended. And then at the beginning of the story, so you were there and you said with Allison, of course, and your manager, your agent, your lawyer. Mm-hmm. So now you have an entourage.
Yeah, I have a team, yeah.
When did that all happen?
So I had written, touring with the boys, I had written...
And I don't mean that as a negative. I mean, that's who you are now at this point. That's a necessary part, but that's a huge change in the evolution of your artistic process, right?
Yep. The other day I was in Rite Aid and I saw there was a magazine that said like, Oprah says the 5 moments that changed her life, you know? And then I started thinking like, what are the 5 moments that have changed my life, right? Because I'm just standing in line and whatever. And then this is definitely one of them. So I had written something like 8 or 9 novels or something at the time. I don't remember. And I would post online about it. You know, again, I'm touring with the boys, blah, blah, blah. I think at this point, yeah, we're still like touring like maniacs. And no. It's just at the end of that period when I like moved in with a friend in Berkeley. And a friend of mine from high school writes me out of nowhere. His name's Dave Simmer. And he writes me, hey, I see that you're like writing a book a month for crying out loud. Like, can I see one? Can I send one to this lawyer friend of mine who represents authors in LA? And I was like, what? Wait, you know, what do you mean? Like a lawyer? Like, what? There's nothing to law. There's nothing to lawyer here. Like, what's a lawyer going to read this book? And okay. So I foolishly picked one that was a collection of novellas, thinking that if you don't like the first one, maybe you like the second one. If you don't like this, you know. No, nobody wants a collection of novellas. They want a kick-ass novel. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I sent him that. And then the lawyer called me, and he was like, hey, I read what Dave sent me, and I would love to represent you.
And was it Bird Box?
No, okay. It's called Goblin.
Okay.
And Goblin has come out, and we're shopping that as a TV series right now. And so he calls me, he's like, I love it, I'd love to represent you, and I think I have the perfect manager for you. This manager is now like my best friend. He's my age. We met, what is that, like 11 years ago this was? Ryan read Goblin and he was like, I want to represent you, you know? So then Ryan and I worked on rewriting one novel of mine. Like he had suggestions. He's brilliant dude. He had suggestions and then I'd make these changes. This is for like a year and a half.
So is this the first time you ever really had intentional feedback like that on your, okay.
Ever in any form really.
I'm just so, and we'll have to come back to it because I'm just so fascinated by how you stayed motivated to keep writing or you just need to be writing, right? That you're so what were you before you had?
I never shopped it to agents, the books. I never.
So were you sharing the books? Like what were you doing?
Like on the road, I would hand them to the other bands we played with. I would print one out at like Kinko's and I'd be like, here, read this. And I would like, I was handing them out like right in
the. And there you're printing
out the rough draft of Bird Box. I handed out like 20, 30 of them on the road.
So you're just printing them out at Kinko's on 8.5 by 11 with a giant paperclip and just handing them out to people for free.
Exactly.
And then it's done and you go on to the next.
Yep.
And you like,
without a rewrite or anything.
And you're not expecting anything out of it. You weren't doing this,
like, this
with the
awesome.
Intention. Yeah. So I think most people, this is awesome. Read this. So I think most people are, you know, so agenda driven or they're writing with the outcome in mind. They want to make a lot of money or they want to be famous. But you weren't. You were just writing for the love of writing and you would finish. You'd hand out a few copies and then you'd write.
But there's a couple things to remember. It's funny because I'm like arguing against this noble thing you just said about me. But there's a couple things to remember. Number one, I don't have any kids and didn't. So, you know, a guy, a 30-year-old that's writing that has kids might be more inclined to be like, I got to make some money at this. And also, I had a sort of like an outlet. Like our band was playing shows every single night.
Mm-hmm.
So there was like that artistic like sharing thing was satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a hobby. Writing was not a hobby, writing these novels. It wasn't like, ooh, I think maybe I'll write today.
It's interesting.
It was like full blown, like you have to do this every day and this is getting better every day and this kind of thing. I was like crazy about it.
But it's so interesting. So you were getting better every day, but you, what were the standards that you were holding yourself to know you're getting better every day?
I don't know.
Because
I just
until
like instincts or something. You could just like tell, you could feel it. Like I had tried to write 4 novels before writing the first one. And one of them even made it 300 pages and I stopped, you know?
And really? Do you think you'll ever go back to it?
Well, I have looked at it recently. I have a crate in my office and that book's in there. And I looked at it recently and I was like, oh, wow. But that's 31 books ago now.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, Josh, you're just so motivated.
I mean, again, no kids, no day job, thanks to now the books and the theme song, right? No day job, no kids. All the time all day. Like before coming here, I wrote and rewrote. And when I leave here, I'm going home to rewrite another two chapters.
I mean, for most people, it's easy to get distracted. For a lot of people, like I'll often say, you know, working from home is much harder than people think it is, right? Because there are so many distractions and, you know, you don't have a set time where you're clocking out and going to lunch, you know, with your peers. You're not stopping and taking a break by the cooler and talking about cool music. You have to be so disciplined. So what is that like for you? Do you have a very specific process in the morning or throughout the day?
Like it goes book by book. Bird Box, I wrote, I woke up at 7 every day, was writing by 8 and was done by noon every day. So it was about 4 hours a day. And it was, God, that book, that rough draft was a freaking explosion, man. But there's been a few like that. And then there's another one that I wrote at night, but almost every session was at night. It's like there seems to be a pattern for each book.
Oh, interesting.
But the thing that's consistent is it's you write every day with each one of them.
Yeah.
Or I do, whatever.
So I'm giving a speech on Thursday and it's like stressed me out. It's been on my head. And so, and I just need to sit down and do it. So Thursday I was at a hockey tournament with my boys and I let them run around the hotel and I just sat down and got my cup of coffee. And I do my best writing, not that I'm anything like you, but anything that I need to sit down and put words together, I do my best work in the morning. I feel like if I miss that sweet spot, then I've got to go for the next day. And
I know what you mean for sure. Yeah, I think that's I have the same sweet spot. I do. And then, but it's not easy for me to wake up at 7 every day.
Right.
You know, Austin and I stay up like super late. We host parties. We're like, you know, but I do think that the best ones have come in the morning.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that again with Mallory. It's been in the morning.
I've been thinking about this a lot lately. So, you know, I have 4 little boys and you know they have a lot of homework because they go to Country Day.
We live right by there. We're at 13 in Telegraph.
Oh, okay. So they have more homework as fifth graders than I had maybe like in high school. Right now they want to do their homework like at the end of the day. And I don't want them to dread. I feel like doing homework is kind of setting the precedent for life, right? So it's kind of setting their work ethic. And I don't want them to, as adults, put off things and then dread doing homework or during work. I want them to wake up and do it first thing in the morning. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. That's interesting. No, that's cool.
So I guess the next question is, what happens to Mallory?
You mean in the book?
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. Do you think Sandra Bullock will be playing Mallory again?
Oh, man. I mean, she has to. I mean, can you imagine her hearing that? Oh, I have to? That is absolutely the fantasy, the goal, the whatever. I've talked to, you know, my manager about this like a million times, you know,
I mean,
that kind of thing.
But with the success of Bird Box, I can't imagine she wouldn't be interested in it. I would imagine as an artist, she's got to be curious about what happens to Mallory.
You know, I'm not trying to sound like I'm running for office by giving a non-answer, but I think that right now I'm like, just finish this book. Don't think about that too much.
Yeah.
Don't think about it. And then when I'm done, I'll send it to everyone involved and we'll see. I don't know if that means that it'll go to her right away. I have no idea.
So is Mallory finished yet?
Nope. I'm very close. So I'm like 250 deep and I think it's probably going to go around like 300.
Okay. So there was something I read and I think it was around Bird Box and I think it was around the monsters and you're talking about I'm trying to explain infinity. Was it in the Bird Box? In the book. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I of course didn't read the book, but that resonated with me because I feel like I'm often saying to people, it's like trying to comprehend eternity.
Yeah.
And rarely does anyone ever understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So for all of our listeners, try and comprehend eternity. You can't.
Yeah.
Right? It's like
not only can you not, but it's like it's a scary thing if you start thinking about it too much.
Oh yeah.
If you really, really fasten your mind to it, you're like, wait, what?
So I grew up in very religious environments and where sometimes it was often like fear-based religion, right? And not intentionally, but you know, sometimes religion can be like that, right?
Oh, yeah.
It instills fear in you. And if you don't follow these rules, you're going to hell and you're going to hell for eternity. Well, as a child, it's very literal and you try and think about it and it drives you mad.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was researching you and I saw that you, or I read something about infinity and trying to comprehend that drives you mad, I completely understood what you were talking about.
Yeah, because I started with just this woman and two kids in a rowboat blindfolded, just because that to me was sort of like a horror, just a freaky image or scenario. Could this mother navigate this river? But when I say started, I mean like the day I had that idea. And by the next day, I was like, wait, why are they blindfolded? What are they afraid to look
at? How'd
they
get here?
Yeah, how'd they get here? What are they afraid to look at? What are they fleeing? And then the only thing that really came to mind was like something they couldn't fathom, like something a concept. So imagine the doorbell rings, you open the door, and infinity's on your front porch. Hello. And you're like, oh. But we are ill-equipped. We're incapable of
fathoming. Like, it never ends.
So what happens if it walked in your house?
Yeah.
What happens if it walked upstairs? If it laid in bed next to you, what happens?
Yeah.
Are you going to lose your mind?
Yeah.
Because you're forced to fathom it?
Right. So everyone listening should hit pause for just a second and just sit there and try and think, it never ends. No, it never ends. And then unpause and come back and finish listening to the rest of this.
That's awesome. Wait.
But that reminds me, I think one of the moments in the when I was watching the movie where I was screaming at the TV was around the river. I'm trying not to give anything away, and I don't think I am. And Sandra Bullock is with the two kids, and they're in the woods. And the little girl lifts up her blindfold, and she has her eyes closed. And I was so nervous that she was going to open her eyes, and I was screaming. And and I thought I made it through, and then I was up at 3:30, traumatized.
And there's a scene in that movie that is not in the book, which is, I think it's the best scene in the movie, which is that moment where it's intimated that she's going to have one of the kids look on the river. That they're under the blanket, and the girl's like, I'll do it, you know?
Well, first the boy says he'll do it.
And that scene is not in the book. And I talked to the screenwriter after. I'm like, is there any way I can, how can I retroactively add that? That's like the best. That's so good.
Oh, that's an interesting question. So the screenwriter, what was the process like of working with him?
Well, I mean, I didn't. I now know him.
They just take your book and interpret it.
I now know him well.
Okay.
He runs like a production company, and I've flown out to LA numerous times to pitch him and his company like other ideas.
Oh, okay.
I've gotten lunch and drinks with him. Like Eric and I would say we're even friends. Okay. Eric and I. But to start with, it was just, I met him because, so originally Universal Studios picked up Option Bird Box, and then the producers they brought to Universal. Netflix ended up buying it from Universal. So originally Universal and the producers had me on like conference calls with prospective screenwriters. And the only reason I was there is because I knew the book better than them. Better than the producers, better than anyone. So I wasn't actually there to make a decision for them. But at the end of each conversation, what did you think? Did you like that guy's take? That kind of thing. And Eric was one of like the four screenwriters that I talked to. And he wrote that movie Arrival. And he wrote wrote some other stuff too. Arrival's great. That movie's great. But anyway, so in the earliest part of it, I mean, he would send me emails saying like, hey, you know, I'm working on it. Like I'm trying to keep it as much of the book as possible, stuff like that. And I would see him at a couple meetings here and there. And at some point it became like, we never worked together, but at some point it started to feel like him and I were in a similar boat somehow. We were the writers.
Yeah.
We were the writers in the room, and everyone else was the producers or the actors, you know?
All right. So we're out of time, but we have so much more we could talk about. So God. Will you come back?
Yeah. I would
bring Allison.
Yeah. I would love to.
Bring anybody you want.
God, when I pulled in, I was like, Allison, I really wish you were here right now, man.
Oh, I wish she was here too. Yeah. Well, next time. Before we wrap up this interview, where can we find you? I mean, where can't we find you?
I have a website, but
you're everywhere.
I have a website, but I need to get on that. I'm glad you asked that, actually. Okay, it's just joshmallerman.com, but there's a free short story up there. I need to get on that, though, updating that more. But mostly it's just Facebook, and it's just my name, Josh Mallerman.
Okay.
And Twitter, same thing.
And Bird Box. So people should read Bird Box, they should watch Bird Box, and then they're going to be ready for when Mallory comes out.
Yeah.
I'm really excited.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to wait for the movie, though, because I can't handle it. But it's been super fun talking to you.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, I seriously feel like we could have gone three times as long. Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to come back, and you're going to bring Allison and maybe bring some other people in the crew, and we're going to talk about Mallory, and we're just going to keep it going. This is awesome. So, all right, thanks, Josh.
Yes, thank you.
This has been the Karma Has Spoken podcast. If you like today's content, feel free to share our show by email, social media, or any other means. If you've got a question, comment, or other feedback, visit our website at karmahasspoken.com. Keep up with us by subscribing to Karma Has Spoken in your favorite podcast app, or follow Karma Has Spoken on social media. Karma Has Spoken is a production of Jag and Detroit Podcasts.